When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Hi everyone, it's Connor Boyle here, and before we go to today's episode, I have an important announcement to make. As you know, Intelligence Squared is about letting you engage with the world's most brilliant minds to challenge your thinking on the biggest conversations of our time. Whether it's through our podcast, debates, or live streams, we believe that by presenting in a civil and respectful way both sides of the argument, we can expand people's perspectives. This is the only way to combat all that polarization we're increasingly seeing in our world. To quote J.S. Mill, he who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. If you believe in this mission, we think you should support us through Intelligence Squared Premium. Your support will directly help us to make even more amazing podcasts, debates, and live streams, stage more great live events, take Intelligence Squared to fresh audiences to hear their perspectives, so that we continue the work of expanding horizons and escaping echo chambers, and your support will get you even closer to the world's most brilliant minds. By signing up, you'll get ad-free listening, because I know some of you would prefer not to listen to those. One early episode per week, two bonus episodes per month, like our sit-down with Daniel Kahneman.
I think we should be talking about how to make democracy work better than it does. The reason that I'm raising that question is that I can't think of a good answer. But I wish, perhaps, if Intelligence Squared arranged a debate, maybe there would be one. I would actually refuse the booking because I would say I'm a pessimist and I have no idea how to solve the problem. But perhaps there is an idea. And there are optimists around, so they should be heard.
And if you sign up through Supercast, you'll also get a 25% discount on Intelligence Squared Plus, our exciting new streaming service where you can watch along or even join the conversation to ask your questions, a 15% discount and priority access to live events so that you won't miss out on tickets for those, and our new premium monthly newsletter, which includes event write-ups, commentary from other subscribers, and a curated list of the most impactful articles our team has been excited by in the past month. This is now available on all podcast platforms, including Spotify. And as a special thank you, you'll receive a 20% lifetime discount off the regular £4.99 a month or £49.99 a year if you sign up before August 31st. It takes less than 30 seconds to sign up, so go to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description. Thanks again for all your support. Now, on to today's show. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. We're dipping into the archive today for a conversation from 2020 with journalist, novelist, and war reporter Scott Anderson. He joined us to talk about his book, The Quiet Americans, which focuses on spycraft, the Cold War, and the West's relationship with Russia. Of course, it's a discussion we can all learn a bit more from today. Host for this interview was Hugo Lindgren, the writer, producer, and former editor of the New York Times Magazine. Here's Hugo with more.
So Scott, I'm gonna tell the audience a little bit about you if they haven't bought your book yet, which they obviously should do immediately. Scott is a veteran foreign correspondent and a war reporter. He's worked for many places, including the New York Times Magazine, where we knew each other a little bit a few years ago. His last book was Lawrence in Arabia, about T.E. Lawrence, the infamous British intelligence officer. And Scott, why don't we just start with a super basic question, kind of bring everybody up to speed, including some who might not be familiar with the book yet. It's about the underpinnings of the United States sort of modern intelligence apparatus starting in and around World War II. Could you give us a quick overview of the ground you cover in the book?
Yeah, I focus in on essentially a 12-year period from 1944 towards the end of the World War II through to the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. And I chose this period because in 1944, FDR was still president, and he was talking about what what was going to be the end of World War II was meant the end of the European colonial empires, the British and the French. They were causing so much disenchantment and rebellion throughout the developing world. And that also the United States was going to be this kind of a beacon of democracy. It was going to export democracy around the world. And he had this idea of the United Nations was going to be this transnational problem-solving agency. Fast forward to 12 years later, and by 1956, the United States is now actually bankrolling the British and French empires around the world, and they're fighting insurgencies against communism in Asia and in Europe, Africa. And America's now overthrowing, rather than spreading democracy, we're actually overthrowing democratic regimes in Iran and Guatemala. So I saw this kind of 12-year period of the beginning of the Cold War as really the kind of solidified everything that was to come over the next 35-year history of the Cold War.
Now, I want to ask a really basic question. Why does FDR's vision not outlive him? I mean, it sounds, you know, very consistent with where the country was coming out of World War II, this, you know, sort of heroic war, at least from the perspective of the United States liberating Europe from fascism. Where's the switch?
I think in a nutshell, it was that the American people in general, but especially Truman, when he comes in April of 1945, The war was over. World War II was over. The Americans were demobilizing at the rate of 15,000 soldiers a day just coming home. Whereas the Soviets, they kind of saw World War II as round one. And now round two is the West. And so very quickly, the Soviets had conquered or liberated Eastern Europe, depending on one's perspective. They very quickly solidified those countries as part of the Soviet bloc. And so there's this very critical kind of two-year period where, to my mind, Truman and American foreign policy in general was kind of asleep at the wheel. The focus was domestic, and they really weren't paying attention to what was happening around the world and the kind of solidification of communist governments throughout, especially in Eastern Europe.
So do you throw a lot of that on Truman? I mean, your portrait of him is not very generous. Is that a big piece of it, his general sort of lack of qualifications for the job, his lack of worldliness? Is that a big piece of it?
To my mind, yes. I mean, I think that if you look at sort of turning points of American history, one particularly tragic crossroads was Roosevelt dying when he did. It's one of the great what-ifs. What if in the post-war era Roosevelt had been there? Would he have been able to deal with Stalin in a way that Truman just did not? I really feel that Truman was kind of a deer in headlights. And partly this is Roosevelt's fault, too, because Truman was kept completely in the dark. People around Roosevelt knew he was really ill and, frankly, dying for the last 8 months before he died. And no effort was made to bring Truman on board to give him any sense of what was going on. Truman didn't know about the atomic bomb being developed, for example, until the day after he became president. So I think Truman was really was just kind of at sea in this really crucial point.
You described this pretty interesting moment with Truman where I don't know if it was his first meeting with Stalin, but one of the early ones in any case. And he's sort of impressed by him and has this kind of almost Trump-like kind of like gut reaction to him, that he's like a man he can trust or something. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was their very first meeting. It was at Potsdam, the Potsdam Conference, in August of 1945. So the war is still going on in Japan. It's just ended in Europe, and Truman met Stalin for the first time. And he wrote in his personal diary, Stalin is honest. He's smart as hell, but I can deal with him. So in kind of like 12 words, kind of got three things wrong.
Yeah, that old sort of folksy gut instinct. So in the early days, in the early post-war era, as the Soviets kind of building up its military presence in Eastern Europe, the United States is retracting, the sort of intelligence operations kind of stepping into the breach in a sense. What's the goal? What's the aim? Like, what do these sort of young men who are charged with with running these intelligence operations? What are they trying to do?
You know, it's a great question. I think they didn't really have clear direction. And one of the characters in my book, Peter Sichel, and this really shows you just how clueless the Americans were of, you know, the Soviets were very clear of what the new conflict was. And there was a tremendous element of wishful thinking on the Americans' part that somehow the wartime alliance with the Soviet Union will continue in the post-war. So Peter Sichel is sent to Berlin in the fall of 1945. So the war is just over. He's put in charge of the first covert operations unit, a clandestine unit of the American military in Berlin. Berlin now is like ground zero of the coming Cold War. So at that time, there's certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of Soviet intelligence agents running around Berlin. Peter's unit consists of 9 guys, and he's heading it, and he's just turned 24. So just there in a nutshell just tells you how completely ill-equipped the Americans were of what was coming. So what you start seeing is guys like Peter and other people in the field, they're reporting back to Washington, hey, the Soviets are taking over all these countries. They're undermining the political parties. They're using all these strong-arm tactics. And it, for this crucial period, it's like Washington just didn't want to hear it or couldn't figure out how to counteract it anyway, because, again, we're demobilizing our military at this incredible rate.
So one of the things that Sichel gets up to in Berlin is making connections with a bunch of former Nazis, and in at least one big example, but I think others as well, making deals with them and using their sort of expertise and their contacts to further their own sort of intelligence operations. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, this is an area where there's a lot of sort of general awareness of it, I think, but you have some real sort of specific cases in the book of sort of collaborating with ex-Nazis.
Yeah, there's this kind of gradual process of the use of the Nazis in the post-war era. They were first, you know, basically Germany was prostrate at the end of the war, and the Americans first came in with this idea that anybody who had served in any role, who had been a member of the Nazi Party, was now going to be effectively banned. Essentially, what George Bush did in Iraq, of de-bathification of Iraq, very quickly turned unworkable, because you know anybody who was running anything in Nazi Germany weren't members of the Nazi Party. So very quickly, They start working with former Nazi Party members. That became especially true with intelligence, because to find out what was happening in Eastern Europe, Americans had nobody during the war who was aware of what was happening in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe. So they start using these former German military intelligence officers. And then it just kind of becomes this gradual process that, you know, first you're using them just for analysis, but then you're using them for operations, to the point where the CIA inherited a bunch of these guys from the Army Counterintelligence Corps. And now all of a sudden you're dealing with some really bona fide, you know, really creepy characters and guys wanted for war crimes. In the particular case of Peter Sichel, and this is what's kind of interesting in this, is that Peter was actually from a German Jewish family. His family had fled in the mid 1930s when Hitler came to power. They got to the States, and so because Sichel was obviously a fluent German speaker, is one of the reasons he was being put into Berlin. So here is one thing Peter told me. He's still alive, and I did a series of interviews with him. He said, you know, whenever I would try to recruit a German, they always wanted to have, quote, the conversation with me. And that conversation being, you know, I was always against Hitler. You know, I hid Jews in my basement. And Peter said, as soon as they would start in, I would say, stop. I don't want to hear it. What you did during the war is between you and your conscience. From now on, I just want you to be on our side and be a good German. So he had this kind of amazing ability to sort of put out of his mind the past of these people, which is probably what made him such a good spy master. But it also set him on this path where, and one particularly notorious Nazi war criminal, he basically helped come up with this false identity to help him get out of Germany into the United States. And this man, his name was Otto von Bolschwing, ended up, in it, you know, 40 years later, being investigated by the Office of Special Investigations of the Justice Department for Nazi war crimes.
40 years later after living in the United States.
That's right. He was in the States for about 40 years. Stripped of his citizenship, he was about to be deported when he died of brain cancer. But really, this guy was really a nasty piece of work. And I had this interview with Peter where I was talking about the use of Nazis. And I kind of reached up to the point where I wanted to ask him specifically about this Otto von Bolschwing. Because I had Peter's name on documents that, you know, kind of helping hide this guy's identity from Nazi war crime hunters. And I just kind of couldn't bring myself to kind of pin him to it. You know, here's a 97-year-old man. Very easy for us or for me 70 years later to kind of stand in judgment of what these guys, the situation that they were in. And there was this moment where Peter absolutely knew where I was going. And he just said, you know, back then I did things that I wouldn't do now. I believed in things that I don't believe now. And then he said, that's it. And I was just like,
so you let it go there. You didn't press him any further than that.
I just, you know, it's one of my failings as a journalist. I mean, you know, we're trained to, like, you know, that's the niche you drive your stiletto in and you see what happens. But I guess, you know, my sense of just being a decent person that kind of won out. I mean, here's a 97-year-old man who obviously has lived with this in some form on his conscience all these years, and he has created a narrative for himself to kind of explain it. And it's like, you know, who am I to kind of come
along? And in a sense, there's not a mystery about it. You had the documents, you knew what he did.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a piece of information that was missing.
No.
You know,
No, and I think, you know, I mean, you know, if you're in this, you know, when you're talking about spy wars, I mean, you get into bed with some pretty unsavory characters all the time. And I think that this is one of the kind of moral things that eventually eats away at people, is that there's this political expedience that you have to go along with that. And at a certain point, maybe you reach a point where you just can't do it anymore, but you're always thinking about, you know, it's the ultimate end justifies the means.
Now in Berlin in the sort of mid and late 40s, Sichel has his sort of nine men. He's running these ops. He's trying to recruit sort of double agents and sources and spies on the sort of Soviet side of things. And reading your book, I'm struck by just how it just feels like one colossal blunder or failure after another. I mean, there's just all their little networks getting rolled up, you know, where they think they're getting stuff, but actually everybody's a double agent and they're, you know, it's what are the success stories that they built the great tradition of the American intelligence operation on? Where were the moments where they're like, oh, finally, we got this one right.
Right. I mean, very, very few and far between, and certainly in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe was just kind of an unmitigated disaster. One thing that you mentioned about it was in 1946. So Peter Sichel had just been in Berlin for a year. They were trying to get a sense, what's called an order of battle. They were trying to find out just how militarily prepared the Soviet Red Army was in Eastern Germany. You know, did they have like offensive plans? So they rolled out these huge chains of agents all through agents and sub-agents throughout Eastern Germany, East Berlin. And they thought they were getting great material. And then literally in a 48-hour period, all their chains disappeared. The Soviets had been watching them all along. Everybody got pulled up. And this was kind of a pattern. When they were doing these commando operations behind the Iron Curtain of dropping anti-communist partisans behind the lines, the Soviets saw, in some cases, these anti-communist emigre groups were so infiltrated by the Soviets that they were waiting for them on the ground when these guys parachuted in. Almost all these operations were just complete disasters. Probably a bit more successful in Asia, than in Eastern Europe. But what you saw time and again was the whole culture of secrecy in the Soviet Union in particular, but in the communist world in general. The CIA was just caught completely flat-footed. Never saw the North Korean invasion of South Korea coming in 1950. Thought that the Soviets were still like three years away from developing an atomic bomb when they actually got it. And one thing that stunned me I just had no clue of this. The CIA had nobody, they had no informant anywhere inside the Soviet hierarchy around Stalin. And not even like, you know, a fifth tier bureaucrat in the Ministry of Agriculture. I mean, nobody, let alone, you know, someone close to the Kremlin who could kind of gauge what might be coming next. So they really were operating in the dark.
And meanwhile, the Soviets, I mean, the head of, not, I guess he wasn't the head, but the, I'm forgetting his first name, Philby.
Oh, Kim Philby, yeah.
Kim Philby was in on some of the most confidential U.S. operations too. I mean, he was Soviet agent, so it does seem like incredibly disproportionate.
Yeah, Kim Philby, he was the British intelligence liaison to the American intelligence, so he was in this. He was based in Washington during this really critical period, and he had access to everything. He had the minutes of the top secret conversations going on between the American and British heads of state. Knew all about the nuclear programs that were being developed. The interesting thing with Philby is when all these operations, once he got unmasked finally in the early 1950s, he kind of became the dumping ground for these anti-communist commando operations that had been going all through Eastern Europe that had all been disasters. When Philby was unmasked, all these failures kind of got dumped on him.
Right, it's all his fault. Right.
When in actual fact, or certainly the probability is that he was so high up, the Soviets were not using him for these to report on these commando operations going. They had those already wrapped up. I mean, they used him for this very high end stuff, you know, between Truman and the British Prime Minister.
It seems almost crazy to ask the question this way, but what would have been different if, like, the United States had done almost nothing? I mean, it does seem that it's like a net negative, their influence on the sort of course of events. And if in addition to sort of pulling back militarily, we just, like, or not developed our intelligence apparatus the way we did, what would have been different?
It's a great question. I'll answer in two ways. One, what you do see in the early post-war period is, for instance, like in Italy in 1948, they're having elections. It looked like actually the Communist Party of Italy might win and then might take Italy into the Soviet orbit. The CIA launched this massive subterranean funding of the Social Democrats and Christian Democrats and managed to kind of defeat the communists at the ballot box. Similarly, there, you know, probably in the Communist Party at one time in France was really powerful. So there may have been this kind of defensive capability that they had, you know, during the containment policy that may have had from our vantage point, a positive influence in Western Europe. But by and large, not much. The other great irony with the CIA of all these different, there was this whole gamut of programs the CIA was running from the 1940s through the 1960s. Everything from, you know, kind of hard power of overthrowing governments, but also this soft power of Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, these cultural programs that they were operating all through Western Europe in the 40s and 50s. Overseas Library Program, which is a CIA operation funneled through the State Department. It was literally just setting up these massive libraries, you know, all through Western Europe where, you know, people come in off the street and you know, check out books and stuff. Those were probably the most effective. I mean, this is a great irony. It's kind of, libraries were more effective than bombs too, in this idea of spreading, you know, kind of American cultural and cultural going to political influence around the world.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. For more information, go to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description. Thank you for your support.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And certainly more effective than spies too. I mean, not just the bombs, but the, what's the biggest, in the course of your reporting, what did you learn that was sort of about the nature of intelligence and U.S. intelligence in particular that changed your mind? Like, were there any sort of preconceptions you had or basic understandings that were proven wrong or at least substantially different by the stories you unearthed?
Probably the biggest takeaway I came away with was I had no idea just this almost daily onslaught of events from the end of World War II, certainly through the rest of the 1940s. Virtually, I mean, not every day, but every third day, to be honest, some kind of cataclysmic thing was happening around the world. And I think America just didn't know how to kind of respond. They were really overwhelmed by events. You know, America was still a very isolationist country, you know, even through World War II. So if something's happening in West Africa, you know, there's very few people even in the State Department who can find that country on a map. So there was this thing of being just overwhelmed by events. And I think also, as I mentioned earlier, I was stunned at the lack of awareness of what they had, the knowledge they had of what was happening inside the Soviet Union. I can now understand better why these guys couldn't sleep at night of wondering what was coming next. Because on the other side of that Iron Curtain, at least until 1953, you have a guy like Stalin, who's essentially a paranoid sociopath, and you don't know what he's capable of doing next or even what he's thinking of doing next. So I think I have a new appreciation for just how in the dark and what a scary time this must have been for people.
Now, you present in the sort of early days of Khrushchev's reign, I guess is the right word, there's sort of a critical moment in Hungary where the Soviets clamp down hard on the sort of nascent rebellion there. And there's kind of an opportunity for the American government to respond and to respond with strength, and they don't. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that's such a big moment? Is that 1955?
56. Yeah, 56. Right, yeah. Okay. So just to back up a little bit on that, where the subtitle comes from, a tragedy in three acts. The third act of this tragedy being when the Eisenhower administration comes in, and John Foster Dulles is the Secretary of State, and he's this ultra-right-wing, hardcore ideologue who has this notion that any sign of rapprochement coming from Moscow is a sign. It's either a sign of their duplicity or a sign of their weakness, or both at the same time. So, whatever Khrushchev does, if it's an aggressive act, if it's an olive branch he's offering, you resist it, you fight back. So, and this is also the period, of course, when the Americans overthrow the democratic government in Iran, then in Guatemala. These were both the early years of Eisenhower. Meanwhile, the Eisenhower administration is just continuing with this propaganda of they're going to roll back communism. They're going to liberate the so-called captive nations of Eastern Europe. And this constant drumbeat of liberation. So then what happens in Hungary in October of 1956 is there actually is a spontaneous anti-communist uprising. Again, CIA never saw it coming. It certainly did not have a hand in provoking it. And it just blows up literally overnight. And it reaches a point where after about 7 days into the revolution, where Khrushchev and the Politburo decide, you know, we have to pull out. We the only way to put this down is by force, and we can't do that. So on this critical meeting of the Politburo, October 31st, 1956, Khrushchev says, we're pulling out. He has a very sleepless night. He gets up the next morning and thinks, you know what? We don't have to give up Hungary, because if the Americans were going to do something, they would have done it by now. The Americans aren't going to come in to help them. So the very next day, Khrushchev ordered the tanks to turn around and go back into Budapest, the capital, and the revolution was crushed. So the Eisenhower administration played this really cynical game of having done, you know, constantly stoked up the idea that there's going to be rebellion, we're going to come to your aid, and then when it happens, they go, oh, you know, sorry, you're on your own. And I interviewed, he's since died, but one of the last American journalists who was in Budapest during the revolution, a guy named Timothy Foote, he describes this awful moment. It was the last day of the revolution where the Soviet tanks have come back in, and they've pushed the rebels or the freedom fighters into this tiny pocket in downtown Budapest. And he was there, and all of a sudden he hears people cheering. And, you know, really happily cheering. And he turns to a fighter. He's in an apartment building next to him. And he says, "What, you know, what's going on?" He says, "Oh, we just heard the Americans have come across the border. You know, the Americans are on their way to help us." And, of course, it wasn't true. And so, you know, within a few hours, all those people were either killed or captured.
So how close do you think the Americans were to actually putting troops on the ground or sending in airplanes? I mean, was it touch and go, or was it just never really on the table?
No, you see, the other thing, well, when Eisenhower came in, he initiated this, and this is kind of a central core idea to the book, is that when Eisenhower came in, he established this thing called the New Look Doctrine. And the New Look Doctrine was basically that the United States reserved the right to massively retaliate if they felt its vital foreign policy interests were at stake. So basically that was a euphemism for a nuclear first strike, that America now reserved the right. It had never been stated before, but we reserved the right to do a nuclear first strike. So of course the Soviets immediately came out and said said the same thing on their own side.
Right.
What nobody kind of put together, I mean, it's astonishing. I just found no documentation of people looking at the New Look Doctrine that anyone kind of put this together. It did two things simultaneously. Number one, it locked into place the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe. The Soviets now could never, you know, invade Germany because that was vital to our national security interests. So it would invite a nuclear first strike. Likewise, the Americans couldn't go into Hungary because that was in the Soviets, you know, strategic sphere. So and then the other thing that New Look did was that, having solidified into place East Europe, it opened up the entire rest of the world as the playground, because now you could create mischief in all these other countries that were not, you know, of vital strategic interest to either superpower. So it had the effect simultaneously of locking Europe into place and opening up the whole rest of the world to the Cold War.
So this brings us to Vietnam and to...
That's right. That's right. And so I think, you know, what happened when Hungary blew up is Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles and his closest advisors sat there and thought, oh, wait a minute. You know, we've done everything possible to promote exactly this thing to happen, but if we do anything about it now, we're going to be flirting with a nuclear war. So they just like wash their hands.
At one point you described the CIA as the ultimate fall guy. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, you asked me earlier if there was anything that kind of surprised me. I'd say one thing that really did surprise me is that not just in the time period I'm looking at, this 12-year period, but kind of going through the CIA's history, all, you know, up to the present day, there's this idea of the agency being this kind of rogue operation at different key moments in its history, you know, that operates on its own. And this is an idea that our current president is actively promoting. But in fact, the agency always operated with at least the tacit approval, if not the instigation, of the American president. So if you look at almost any, certainly any major operation throughout the agency's history, It was all done at the behest of the sitting American president. But it, within the CIA's doctrine is this doctrine of plausible deniability. So one of their whole reasons for being is to take the blame. So if you know, Bay of Pigs, for example, blows up and it's a big fiasco, well, it's the CIA's fiasco. It's not John F. Kennedy's fiasco. And this has been, you know, WMDs in Iraq in 2003. The Bush administration did everything possible to push the agency to find the existence of WMDs. In fact, within the agency, it was a huge debate going on whether they actually existed or not. Of course, they weren't there. Didn't exist, but you know who takes the fall for it? It's the agency let us down. That is the agency's role, is to take blame.
One of the things that struck me about your four characters is that sort of each of them comes across, you know, as sort of a decent person. You know, not a villain, not a fool, not a sort of power hungry madman, and yet their legacy is sort of astonishingly. I mean, I guess it's just depressing. I mean, these very talented, very, in most cases, very well educated. I mean, they were sort of the term that's used later, the best and the brightest, and they spend their, you know, entire careers, you know, ultimately, you know, sort of betraying America's better values. It's kind of sobering.
Yeah, it's and I think it's one of the reasons why. Well, one of them committed suicide, and two of them quit. Two of them quit the CIA, and I think it was seeing, in one case of the two men who quit, one was just seeing the utter futility on the ground of the operations he was involved in. There's a guy who was kind of orchestrating the dropping of guerrillas behind the Iron Curtain. Just saw hundreds of people just, you know, parachute to their deaths. And in the case of Peter Sichel, the reason he quit or kind of reached his breaking point is that he had seen all these operations be such disasters in Eastern Europe. He was the CIA station chief in Hong Kong in 1960, right when East Asia is starting to kind of perk up. He was at a meeting of CIA station chiefs in the Philippines where the new number two guy of the CIA, the head of covert operations, comes out and he goes, "Hey, we're launching a new, you know, a new operation. We're going to be dropping anti-communist Chinese into Mao's China. It's going to be $100 million operation. We're going to, you know, be dropping, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of guys behind the lines." And during a break in this conference, Peter took the number two guy aside and said, "You know, we'd save so much time and money if we just killed them ourselves." He said, "This is going to be a disaster just like it was in Eastern Europe." And then he said, "I'm out. I quit." And he quit the agency just like right there. You know, individually, they kind of reached points where they either broke or they, you know, you just keep going along with it. So
they also had problems sort of domestically, politically in the United States, with particularly with McCarthy and the Red Scare. Maybe you could describe a little bit of some of those details, because that was another stunning part of the book. The, you know, these guys are out there in the field, you know, sort of overmatched and undermanned, and right. and then meanwhile they're you know being called traitors back at home by McCarthy, by some of his allies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this was a huge influence on all four of them. All four of these men, and this is very true of the early CIA. I write about only one of them was really kind of in an Ivy League, but they tended to draw very heavily from the Ivy League. Most early CIA officers were politically liberal, certainly very socially liberal, and certainly all four of them, and I write about it, and throughout the CIA of other people, saw things they had written from the time. To a man, appalled by the Red Scare that was promoted by Joe McCarthy starting in 1950, and really McCarthy was kind of the front man for J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover was the guy who was funneling these confidential files to McCarthy, who would then come out with them publicly. And they saw the effect that the Red Scare, which was really a witch hunt. The effect that was having on American standing, moral standing, and prestige abroad, and especially maybe in Europe, you know, Europeans, Western Europeans, just like, you know, what are Americans doing? And on a personal level, two of the four guys I'm writing about, both Peter Sichel being one of them, were both investigated by the FBI as potential communist spies, and the great irony is in Peter's case is that he'd seen so many of these commando operations be so disastrous. He had started shutting these operations down because it was mass suicide, essentially sending these people over. The CIA officers in the field who wanted to push these programs and they were either getting shut down by Peter Schell started sending, it's like, well, why is this guy, keep closing down our operations that I know this time is going to work? So the fact that he was shutting down so many of these disastrous operations was what made him fall under suspicion as a potential KGB right. mole.
As we're talking, it's September 10th. The president of the United States has been in the news quite a bit, as he always is. And one of the things that's been front and center is some of his comments about the military. And in the discussion of that, people say, well, he's lost the military and, he previously lost the intelligence community. That's like a talking point that people that's out there. What do you think that means, that the president has lost the intelligence community? And do you agree with that? And what would the consequences of that be, the president having lost the intelligence community?
Yeah, we've never been in this situation before. One thing, certainly people I've talked with in the agency the last few years, they see Putin's Russia as an inherently adversarial nation to the United States. We're not friends. We are not. We're certainly not allies. It is an inherently adversarial relationship. I think that they are. Everybody I've ever talked to in the agency, they are both deeply alarmed and deeply suspicious of why we have a president who steadfastly refuses to acknowledge that. Trump's talk about the deep state conspiracy, that doesn't really bother them. I think they know that's kind of politics and it's posturing. But definitely what really worries them, to a man and to a woman, is this utter refusal to recognize what the fundamental relationship is between the United States and Russia, and we see it acted out virtually daily. The fact that the American president has not come out and said anything about the attempted murder of Navalny, 2 weeks ago, the poisoning that was clearly carried out by the Russian secret police. How can an American president, not respond to that? But he hasn't responded to any of the other stuff, including the fact that the Russians were giving bounties to Taliban fighters to kill Americans. How can an American president not talk about that? So that's pretty astonishing.
Does all of this feel kind of fixable to you? I mean, is this one of those? I mean, I think that's the big question around people have around Trump is that 4 years of weakening of American institutions and capabilities, is it something that can be turned around by a different president fairly quickly? Is there long term damage? What's your sense on that?
I think some of it can be turned around very quickly. And I'm reminded of when Obama came in, and took over from Bush. I mean, if you remember, Bush was pretty universally despised, certainly in Europe, by the time he was gone. And so Obama comes in, and he's a rock star. The Europeans love him. I think he had higher approval ratings in Europe than he had in the States. So I think a lot, there's a lot of the world out there that is waiting to America to, from their vantage point, to kind of get their act together and to come back to what it once was and to renew NATO, to be supportive of the European Union instead of trying to, do everything possible to dismantle it, to return to that, the kind of adversarial relationship with Russia. On a long-term basis, though, I think that what is deeply corrosive about this administration is, in the eyes of other people around the world, is like, that, well, the Americans elected somebody like Trump once. What's going to prevent them from electing somebody like him again? And on a large level, this even kind of transcends Trump. But I think one thing that Americans, all around the world, the view that people have of America in general as a power is that you can wait them out. you just play beat the clock with the Americans, and eventually they're going to get tired and go home. And you know, certainly that was Stalin's idea in 1945. It's like the Americans are going to pack up and go home, and they're going to leave the playing field to us. We're about to see it play out in Afghanistan. It's in the works. You know, Americans, just like we did in Vietnam, we're looking for a, you know, quote, decent interval so that we can kind of say, oh, our job here is done. We're going to leave. And then hopefully there's a decent interval before the whole thing goes down the toilet. And that's the all American
it's
policy.
It's been 20 years in Afghanistan, though. I mean, that is a...
That's true. Yeah, that's
pretty,
true. But it's been, you know, it's
a long road.
That has been. But it's been very... And it's probably, you know, and as was Vietnam. We seem to do one or the other. We either, like, you know, like go in very quickly and pull out, and then they're stunned that the whole thing falls apart. Or yeah, we stay in forever and can't figure out how to get out. But certainly the so-called American solution in Afghanistan is going to look almost exactly like the solution in Vietnam.
Since you do know a lot about Afghanistan, I guess I'm confused. I understand, I feel fairly well why Obama doesn't close Gitmo. Like I don't agree with it, but I understand it. I'm not sure I do understand why Trump doesn't have the troops out of Afghanistan.
I think he doesn't want the embarrassment on his watch of watching the Taliban take over. You know, the awful thing of Afghanistan is after all the deaths, all the destruction, we're going to end up, you know, right back where we were almost 20 years ago, once the Americans, you know, pull out altogether. I give it a matter of months before the Taliban takes over, and then you potentially have another, you know, so-called rogue state in the middle of Central Asia because when we leave, we're going to leave completely. I mean, we're not going to have eyes and ears on the ground. And so, you know, the idea of another Al-Qaeda or ISIS coming along and using Afghanistan as a base, it's a distinct possibility.
So I would, from reading your book, I would say that the influence of the CIA on world events generally is hugely overrated. I would say that's a conclusion of your book. Correct me if I'm wrong. What do you think about the CIA is underrated? Like, what are their capabilities or their aims or things that we may not appreciate enough or know enough about?
It's a really good question. Kennedy had this said, you know, the thing about intelligence agencies is that their failures are very public and their successes are unknown. And I think that that's largely true with the CIA. If something is successful, you just never really hear about it. So I think that they've probably been fairly effective in certain places in Asia, certainly in Africa. But I'm kind of hard pressed to say what, like, to point to something on a major level. Well, again, you know, this goes way back. Presumably, they've had a success, you know, before this. But you know, I mentioned the Italian elections in 1948. It was this very comprehensive program designed to neutralize the legal Communist Party. America had a doctrine: we don't interfere in the elections of other democracies. That went by the wayside in 1948, as it has in other countries since. You know, and I was thinking, you know, the countries I grew up in, Taiwan and South Korea, which had a huge both American military and American intelligence involvement, you know, certainly throughout the 60s and 70s, kind of success stories. But is it a success? You can, you know, they're both functioning democracies now. But is that something? I've never had the sense that that was something that the CIA or the American government, you know, actively pushed those countries to do. I mean, it came about, I think, much more organically. So long way around to your question. I think the answer is you often just don't know what where they've been successful.
So we're back to where we started from, in a sense. Maybe the influence on world events is not, right, not overrated.
Exactly.
So I want to close by asking for a recommendation. First of all, I want to make sure I give a recommendation in terms of your book, because I think what's really truly wonderful about it is it's very much engaged in the nitty gritty and the history of the United States in the mid-century, but it's also just a really sort of excellent kind of adventure story with a lot of different characters and a lot of really cool areas of the world, and it's just an exciting reading experience. So I want to make sure people know that too. This is not Scott does not press your you know, nose up against all these depressing facts and force you to acknowledge them. It's really a very pleasurable reading experience. But I want to ask you for a recommendation. I guess personally, what I would most want to know is there a great spy novel that you love? And I'm going to ask you not to pick one of the obvious ones. I might even have to take John le Carré off the table. But is there a work of fiction or nonfiction that you think gets aspects of this world right, or that you just think is something people should read?
You know, one of my all-time favorite books, I suppose it's a spy book, is Our Man in Havana, okay, by Graham Greene. It's just, of course, Graham Greene was an intelligence officer, but it really gets to, it's just a wonderful book. It's funny, but funny in a very acerbic, dark way. And not to give anything away about it, but it basically a guy starts cooking information that he's sending back to London to basically raise money. And the more information he sends, the more it becomes this kind of, you know, vital national security concern of what's happening in Havana. And it does get to something about the absurdity of that whole, the spy world. And how information can be manufactured. But from a more realistic standpoint, even though you took him off the table, I have to say le Carré. Le Carré really does, again, another former intelligence officer, but the sadness, and the solitude of being a spy, being a double agent, having a secret life, and as alienating as that is, it sounds very cool when you're on the outside. But, you know, you're it creates a distance between you and everyone around you, including your own family. And le Carré really gets that.
Is there one that stands out in your mind as a personal favorite?
Probably Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, I would think. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You really, I mean, I have to agree, but if you haven't read it yet, you have to read Scott's book first, but then you can get Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Anyway, Scott, thanks a lot. This has been really a lot of fun, and appreciate you joining us. This has been the Intelligence Squared podcast with Scott Anderson. He is the author of The Quiet Americans, a new book about the history of the American intelligence sort of apparatus. It's a terrific book, and thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Hugh. I really appreciate it.